I never liked playing sports. My interests were more in the arts and cooking. When I was upset, I often would cry and show my emotions and feelings to my parents and to my friends. When I was angry or upset, I would cry and become more withdrawn. I was also frequently bullied, called a girl, and a fag. I always talked with these issues with my mom and dad. I was very open to them, often at the expense of being called a mama's boy. Now, this story's fake. That's not me. However, what I'm here to talk to you about and to introduce the story about what the boy code is and what it's about is to show the contrast of maybe when I came up here, maybe you thought some things about me right away. Maybe you kind of made some prejudgments, as we all do. But what I illustrated hopefully a little bit in that brief little starter was the boy code is alive and well. And it's alive and well in each and every one of us, whether you're a male or a female. So I share that story to really kind of capture a little bit of what this whole talk and topic is about. So thank you for humoring me on that. Welcome to the session. Awesome presentation so far from my two previous presenters. So I do have one note, not necessarily conflict of interest, but I am an author of a textbook. I do receive financial reward from that, although not much. So in this session, hopefully, and also thank you for the presenters giving me about 45 minutes to talk here, so that's always nice. Hopefully, by the starter, as well as some of the things that I will present to you in the coming slides, you'll have a better concept of what the boy code is about. More importantly, how do we use it to understand how this relates to a lot of the things that, for example, Dr. Griffith talked about with morbidity, mortality, and as Dr. Reynolds talked about earlier with masculinity. So kind of a nice, cool connection, hopefully, here. Also, how these social determinants can actually be modifiable when we look at data from bigger data sets like the BRFS and also the YRBS. And, of course, that is the other part that I'll talk about, which is what are some things that we can take from the YRBS, the Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance System, and kind of dissect it a little bit. The title of this presentation is Unpacking the Boy Code. So I think it's more of a rich discussion to talk about how do we actually use it, not necessarily what it is. And then finally, I'm kind of ahead of myself today, how do we integrate that into the policies and programs that a lot of you are working with or considering or doing, which is what we're here to do in this conference anyway. So for fear of replication of my other slides, I apologize if you are in some other sessions. I do plagiarize myself sometimes. And this was already covered. We do know that men across the board do suffer from some of the worst health conditions. They suffer from the highest rates of morbidity and mortality across the nation, technically across the globe in many countries. And that leads to a lower overall health quality of life, health-related quality of life. I think Dr. Griffith nicely summarized a lot of the racial ethnic disparities in his state. They're a little different in my state, my home state of Massachusetts. But across the board, men are faring worse, and that means families are faring worse. And I want to stress that point. We often talk a lot about genderized types of issues here, but when we say it's men, 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 or it's women, 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 there's a whole connection of families, right? We're a holistic society, and we have to keep that in our minds. And often in public health, we talk a lot about the issues, and I'm one of those people. I will continue to talk about the downstream issues, right? We see all these rates, statistics, morbidity. That's all important. But as the wiser public health professionals have noted, it's looking upstream. It's going to the policies. What are the things that are driving the policies that are leading to some of these downstream issues? And as we can see here, there's a lot of assumptions that are made. That first story I shared with you, right? There were some assumptions there. Well, he's wearing pink and purple. Maybe he is a gay guy or something. Or maybe he's not. Oh, he's wearing a men's health pin. So we have to understand that kind of these assumptions and these social determinants often lead to some of these unacceptable social influences, namely what I'll talk about is the boy code. So I often bring this up as kind of a starter as well, and I think when I was looking at Dr. Griffith's presentation, more than two-thirds of the top four leading causes of death in Tennessee were what types of issues? What did you note? Behaviors, right? Things related directly to behaviors that lead to these morbidities and mortalities. So modifiable, though, right? I think any of us would in public health say, well, that's modifiable. You know, seatbelt usage, education, understanding how do we kind of change policies to make sure we're safer in society. So I look at that as a tremendous opportunity, but again, we continuously see the rates at unacceptable levels. I love pulling from this study from the Kaiser Family Foundation that look at how racial ethnic differences also are driving a lot of these problems within our society. So this report looks at overall health status in the far right-hand column in the solid grid line. Those are some of the issues of the society in the societies that are experiencing the worst rates. So American Indian, Alaska Natives suffer from a lot of overall health status problems. Access utilization and social determinants. So in access utilization, Hispanic Latino, even though contrary to Dr. Griffith's data, which show kind of that protective or illusionary protective effect of Hispanic Latino, it's typically because they're younger. And the younger rates obviously are experiencing problems accessing, getting good quality care coverage. For fear of being political, I won't comment on the quality of the coverage, but oftentimes we kind of put that tick mark and say people are covered. That's great, but what's the quality in that coverage? Do they feel comfortable with their providers? And also, they struggle with the social determinants of health as well, so I think it's important to keep those in mind. So Dr. William Pollack quite a few years back now, came up with this concept of what kind of drives a lot of male behavior. His interest as a psychologist, an adolescent psychologist, was more interested in looking at adolescent males. And I think from reading a little bit of what he looked at, it was based on maladaptive behaviors. So many of you have obviously interacted with younger boys, whether they're your family, your teacher, parent, something like that. And I'm sure you've noted maladaptive behaviors. And they probably range from really horrendous things to kind of like, oh, it's just a boy being a boy. How many of you have heard that? Just boys being boys. How many of you have said that? Just a boy being a boy, right? He's supposed to do certain things. So I agree that boys and girls, people, we do things, right? We make mistakes. That's how we learn. That's how we grow. However, when we normalize things, when we actually stereotype them in our own minds, when we normalize what a boy, or what a girl is supposed to do, we end up having kind of the self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm sure you've heard and thought that. So what Pollack talks about is kind of this societal expectation of what a boy is supposed to do. And as you can see here, and I'll break these four main points down, you have to kind of keep your emotionality in check. Right? You can't be overly emotional. You can't be overly dramatic like I'm doing right now, because that's weird. And boys especially, you don't do that, because now you look different from the rest of the boys, different from the rest of the pack. Violence, right? So when you're emotional, what do? You react to it. You don't necessarily talk it through. You don't talk it out. You actually react to it. And that can take many forms, as pointed out in the previous data that show that could be a violent response. That could be bullying somebody else as an emotional response. The third point, self-esteem relies on power, power struggles, power dynamic, kind of the alpha male in the pack type of mentality. Reading some of his work and Dr. Pollack's work, talks a lot about this notion of boys are more than willing to settle for something, but it's only in the concept of understanding where you are. So once I know that I'm not the best athlete out there, but I know I'm a good contributor to the team, I'm okay with that, and I don't have to fight with the quarterback on my team. So it's an interesting dynamic that younger boys often jockey for power. They also have to reject any signs of femininity. Pink shirts, acting a certain way, the way you talk, the way you walk, anything that could be pulling away your masculinities could also be deemed feminine, which is direct contrast to the boy code. So these are learned at various life stages, different institutions in life, and essentially what it does is it isolates, it disenfranchises boys from what we would consider mainstream society. They kind of create the subculture. So it's an unwritten code. It's something that boys often feel, they experience. They don't necessarily understand it all. They just know they have to do it. That's in a lot of qualitative interviews with younger boys, not my research, but others. They've kind of found that boys kind of know it's there. It's the elephant in the room. But imagine you know something's there, but you just don't know what it is. You don't know why you have to do it. You just know you have to do that. It's an essential. You have to do this, as it says in the second bullet point there. And the third point, which is you fear if you go against it, if you go contrary to some of the things, whether it's the first story that I mentioned or if it's something that you've experienced in your own life, it's anxiety building, isn't it? It's something that really makes you maybe question, should I even be here in the first place, whether it's school, okay? Or if it's, should I go on from school into college? Should I be with this group of friends? Should I not be with this group of friends? So a lot of behaviors are predicted from that. So the boy code specifically, if you break these down psychosocially, it dictates that you need to be a tough person, right? And the notion of tough is very subjective. What does tough mean? You can talk all day about different images of it. I think we saw a nice photo voice presentation yesterday from Dr. Brini about that. The second point here kind of struck me a little bit. It's this distrust of adults. And if you think about it, adults occupy a certain level of power, don't they? They can control your allowance. They can tell you when and when not to be home. They can tell you where you're going, but only to a certain age. The distrust, and I always trusted my parents that they were making decisions that are to my benefit, that kind of, I don't know, that makes me feel a little unsettled, that this code kind of makes sure that you understand that you own the power, the adults don't. You don't do anything that would be viewed as weak or being a sissy. You have to exercise. You have to do it not for health, but you have to do it for muscularity, kind of opposing, kind of an image. You also have to repress your emotions, as I mentioned before. You have to play sports. You have to be good at those sports. You can't just play them. You don't talk a lot. So I'm clearly going in contrast to a lot of the boy code issues. And again, it's this revolution against being feminine or anything related to femininity. So again, just breaking these down a little bit more. So the constructs of what the boy code looks like, the sturdy oak, right? These are kind of images that go against it. So you don't cry. Why do you, if we cry, what happens? You're viewed as weaker, right? So again, it takes away from one's masculinity, the sturdy oak. Give them hell, right? Act the part, show that you're tough. Don't just claim that you're tough, you have to show it. You have to get in fights. You have to take risks, right? You have to take not controlled risks, but risks for the simple fact of showing oneself as strong as, again, sturdy. I can do anything. Clint Eastwood, I think, picks on that pretty well. The third one, the big wheel, right? Domination, power. And it's interesting because when you look at feminist theory, for example, a lot of feminist theory is based upon domination and power, just in a different context. So if you look at someone like Gronkowski, right, he's a dominant football player. I'm from Boston, sorry. But how he's perceived by his peers, by his fans, right, he crushes opponents. No offense to the Jets fans or anybody else in the room. He crushes them. He doesn't just catch the ball. He runs with five guys attached to him. So instead of other football players that are fast, right, they catch the ball, they go score a touchdown, this guy's catching the ball, and he's showing more dominance than even another player at the same level. So we tend in society to look at that as he is the man, right? He is not just a good football player. He's the man. And then the fourth one here, you don't do sissy stuff. You don't do things that are perceived as sissy. So I like arts and entertainment. I think it's really great to watch kind of the skill of everybody, but oh, I can't do that, right? If I do that, my whole masculinity is challenged. The reason why I show you these four points and show the images related to that is because think about how that translates to health and health behaviors, right? The first one, sturdy oak, don't cry. Don't show emotion. That means don't communicate. Don't talk. Don't talk to somebody who could open the entryway to a good interaction with a provider, for example. When you are at a provider, you don't really tell them that much because, again, they may be judging you. So what does that mean and how does that relate to overall health? You don't communicate. You don't receive things. You don't receive things, you miss out. You miss out on information that could protect you. You miss out on maybe that screening that could actually diagnose something early so that you don't have a lot of the morbidities and mortalities. Give them hell, right? Just do anything to prove yourself. Risky behaviors. Don't wear a seatbelt, right? Try something daring. I was just watching a video this morning of people doing these amazing human feats of sports. It was all stupid. You know, jumping off of a cliff around rocks that are like, you know, you have basically like a diameter of maybe 4 feet to hit the mark. Sorry, you know, that's impressive to watch, but it's stupid, right? It's a risky behavior. Dominating. Well, if we're talking about, what about males that are going into college, for example, that have a dominant personality, a dominant, I'm thinking of a specific person in one of my classes. It's confrontational. It can cause a lot of problems. It could mean you dominate over a female peer, make her feel uncomfortable, make another person feel uncomfortable. And then no sissy stuff, right? Health behaviors. So how does a male, for example, prove himself that he's not a sissy, that he's not feminine? He may go contrast to the extreme opposite of what that is, which could take the form of proving one through promiscuous sexual activity or dominating over people. And we know there are legal ramifications and a lot of other things. So hopefully by this point you kind of understand where I'm coming from, a little bit of what the boy code entails. This was pulled from Dr. Schroeder's presentation a few years ago. In the boy code, you know, you need to know what you're doing. You need to know that you look like you know what you're doing. It's a certain level of competence. So the second part with the girls, appearance is important. For boys, appearances are important. So Dr. Schroeder was going through this presentation a few years back. She talked about video game playing. How many of you have played video games? Nintendo, Commodore 64, all the Sega Genesis. So if you've played a video game, she was talking about oftentimes boys will purchase or somebody will purchase the video game for them. Okay? They won't invite their friends over immediately. I'm thinking back to my boyhood, like, yeah, I guess I didn't. Why? Because the boys would have to kind of get a good feel for the game. They would have to, quote, master the game and really understand it. Only then, and I'm like, yeah, that's me, then you would invite over some of maybe your male friends, your peers, and say, do you want to play this game with me? Why do they do that? Because I'm the man. Look at how good I am, right? So now you're playing this, whatever, baseball simulator of 2000, back in 1990-something, and, you know, I'm kicking my friend's butt. And they're like, how are you so good, Jim? Oh, my gosh, look at you. And I'm going, my self-esteem's up there. Yeah, I'm good, huh? I'm good. I'm better than you. I'm dominating over you. So appearances are important. Again, translating these to health behaviors. How does that maybe take a negative connotation, right? So obviously with video game playing, well, you know, that's not necessarily a pathological behavior, but when we translate that mentality to other things that relate to our health, it could, and it does. Boys are also, in the boy code, on this conquest for respect. How many of you have heard that from a younger male in your families or in society, right? You didn't respect me. I often say, well, you don't technically really even know what respect is, because if you're 14, you should be respecting different things, not demanding respect from others maybe that you haven't learned about. So adolescents strive to differentiate themselves. We know that. Again, it's based on what you do. So think of it in the context of this health scenario, right? You do something risky. There's a boy in my town that, 15 years old, he wanted respect from his other friends, peers. He's playing with fireworks. You know the rest of the story, right? So playing with fireworks, what did he do? It was how close could he get to, he set up some like major bomb type of thing. How close could he get before it would explode? And guess what happens? Third degree burns, lost a couple fingers. What did he gain from that? Wow, you're a risk taker. I respect that. Is that something we want to respect? One-upping another. Definitely something related to how masculinity relates to a lot of these issues. Roughhousing, boys will be boys. Humiliating and being humiliated. So I don't know if any of you were the class clown growing up, but this kind of an interesting balance that boys take with being kind of the humiliator, the dominator, versus, oh, I got humiliated. We used to pants each other, if you know what that is, right? So you'd be playing basketball, pickup game, and all of a sudden someone from behind would, right? And you go, ah. So it's embarrassing, but then at some point, I also recognize I have a chance to do that to you. Now, roughhousing and having fun, so to speak, in school, that's one thing, but how does that translate to later behaviors as an adult male? Is that acceptable? Obviously, there might be a slap on the wrist when you're in high school, but as you get older, what does that translate to? Oh, I was just, you know, she was drunk, and I was just, you know, just did some things. It relates to problems that we think in, say, in society as being problematic. And then finally, homophobia, right? Again, don't do anything that could be perceived as feminine. I always have an issue with this because feminine and gay are not the same thing. They might be cousins in some respects, but when we say homophobia versus not being a sissy, I know a lot of men who are straight, they have families, they are in love with their women, but they're not the most masculine guys. So again, I think it comes back to really understanding what is this masculinities that we talk about. Often that's characterized as male bonding. a lot of those behaviors. So let's get down to some of how this translates over from the WireBS data. So the first part, the need to be heterosexual, right? So kind of bring up some of these other things. Oftentimes that need translates to violence. It translates to proving one's masculinity through dominating others. And when we dominate, we often subjugate others. That's part of the problem. So either it could come in the form of verbal abuse, physical abuse, and as you saw in some of the previous reports, that translates to morbidities and mortalities. Needing to have sex. These are from boys interpreting what the boy code means. So they say, I need to have sex. 14-year-olds say, I need to have sex. Okay, well, we know that sex often leads to things. STIs, increased rates of pregnancy, wanting to desperately be good lovers and give their partners orgasms, right? These are words from younger boys who probably are very sexually naive or inexperienced. So again, what does that lead to? What does that suggest? Body image problems, self-esteem problems, and again, more and higher rates of pregnancies and STIs. These boys are also obsessed with penis size, right? So this could be losing money through investing in things like supplements that could harm their long-term health, liver problems, for example, using devices, and just kind of that overarching emotional issues that reside as they become younger men. Concerned about statutory rape, again, that's concerning because, again, it suggests that they know there's a problem there, but they don't know how to navigate, you know, what's okay to send, what's okay to say to another person, what's okay to do, what if she's drunk, how far can I take it, right? So there's a lot of problems around that I won't get into, but sure you know. And then experience love in extremes. There was some reports that showed that males often take breakups harder than women. And the psychosocial parts of coping with that could also lead to things like substance abuse, suicidality, and some of these other problems that we see. So there's, again, a lot of translational behaviors from what the boy code does. So in action, again, gender stereotypes. Boys need to take their emotions and keep them in check. Often not expressing things. I kind of went through that a little bit already. Injury concealment. We have a poster in about an hour from now that talks about sports injury concussions and how that mentality of concealing one's injury because you don't want things taken away from you is something that we'll be talking about over in the lecture hall. Violence as an acceptable response. So again, social ills, mass shootings, not knowing how to translate one's frustrations into the common society that they live in. I've often talked a little bit about when you take a person like, say, Rob Gronkowski, on the field, you need to be a monster. You need to destroy your opponent. You need to be as tough as anything. How do you take that mentality of a teenager and say, but then when you're in school, then when you're in other society, you have to be an extreme gentleman. You have to understand those lines. Ask any 14, 15-year-old boy to understand that, or girl. They're going to probably struggle with that from perspective. Self-esteem, dominating others. Again, domination. It's a good thing in one context, but when we're talking about sexual violence, intimate partner violence, it's not. Also subjugating others, downplaying others. Again, problematic. They have to reject being feminine. So again, the way we eat. How many of you have eaten a good steak? Girls don't eat steak, right? They don't eat ribeye or prime rib, right? Only men do that. Talk with this with my classes. Like, what? We have men eating like men. What does that mean? A salad's a salad, right? So oftentimes rejecting what's feminine translates to health behaviors such as even what you eat, okay? So the WireBS, obviously many of you have seen that. You know what it's about. Used it to kind of take some of these data and make sense of it. So I know it's a little small there. I just want to translate it over here to even smaller text to bother you. If you break down the boy code and how it relates to some of the major findings from the WireBS of 2013, texting and driving, again, that fearlessness, that risk-taking, that I've got it mentality, right? So previously I showed you the boy code has this notion of I can do it, right? Don't challenge me. I got this. Boys often say that. Again, it captures that fearlessness, risk-taking behavior. Drinking alcohol, marijuana, obviously, boys will use it to fit in, as girls will, but also that form of escape, especially after trauma through breakups, which if you've ever seen a teenage boy or girl, breakups are the worst thing in the world, right? Electronic bullying, again, this relates to your mental health, suppression of emotion. We all know we become more powerful behind our media, or cars for that matter, so again, kind of taking a little bit of that. Sexual risk behaviors, again, proving one's masculinity. I was always struck by some of my guest speakers that come into my human sexuality class and talk about who has the highest rates of STIs, who has the highest rates of pregnancy. And it's not your heterosexual boys and girls. It's often LGBTQ boys and girls. Why? People, my students always say, how's that? Well, they're trying to prove to their peers and partners, I'm not gay, or I'm not different, right? So what do? You take on behaviors that actually do put you at risk, and then after the fact, whether you have an STI or a pregnancy or something, then you go, oh yeah, well, I guess I am gay because I am, but you still have now a lifetime of consequences to deal with. A couple of other things here, and I'll be brief with these. Ever had sexual intercourse, proving one's masculinity, prowess, right? So we all know the formula. Boys tell you how many partners they've had. You're supposed to decrease by like a half or something. Girls, you're supposed to increase it by 10 or something. I don't know. But we often have that as a go-get 'em mentality, right? Give 'em hell, and that includes sexual behaviors. Go get 'em. Get them pregnant. Get them, you know, get as many of the, what do we call them, body counts. That's what some of the younger boys and some of our qualitative research were saying. And then finally, a couple of issues related to your behaviors for showing one's masculinity. So smoking cigarettes, using that certain facade, kind of posing as we call it, to be masculine. Eating certain foods, playing certain games like Halo and whatnot. So as I kind of conclude here on some of the thoughts of how the boy code can inform policy, and again, contact me if you want more of these individually. We do need to be more gender sensitive, and we have to start policies in the educational system. It's a captive audience. We've all gone through it. But if we have coaches, for example, or if we have teachers that reinforce the stereotypes of what the boy code's about, right? Just like the first story that I shared with you. If you start stereotyping me, I'm going to start acting the part. Why? Because that's what human beings do. That's our psychosocial behavioral parts of it. So we have to give better sexuality education. I know it's a touchy topic. People often don't want to chat about it. Localities often don't want to endorse it, but it's something that finds its ugly head sometimes in places we don't want it to be. Full range of expression of emotions. That's a tough one, right? Because we all come from different family backgrounds. I was just talking with a young lady last night. She said, I didn't come from a family that talked about anything, and she's very stoic. Well, she's a female, so how do we get boys to open up? Well, it could start with the family level. And then teasing, and I find this a lot in sports. I'm an athletic trainer by trade, and I would often see other athletic trainers, other coaches, kind of demeaning the boys on the team and giving them that motivation of, you know, stop being a whatever you want to call the person, to motivate them. But is that the proper way to coach? Is that the proper way to motivate them? So shaming language, for example, digging deeper when boys display anger and emotion. You know when something doesn't fit, it doesn't seem right. I'm a teacher. I've seen boys kind of have that little edge on them. That's an opportunity to talk, to recognize it, to actually say, why don't you come over here and let me just chat with you for a little bit. I also think we need more of that from males, male role models, male teachers, for example, okay, so that we can kind of get past this frank discussion of what it means to be a male overall and create something that's inclusive and broad. These are some examples of the work that Liz Schroeder's doing. It uses strength, it uses masculinity, it leverages it for positive messages, okay? Instead of always saying it's a bad thing. We almost bastardize masculinity because we think we try to hurt people. But we can actually use it as what it is. It's an opportunity to actually integrate it into good behaviors, positive health behaviors, so on and so forth. So we do need a cultural shift. We need to appreciate that males are males, but there's a diversity in how it's represented through one's masculinities. We need to break the boy code, but we can also work with it. And the better job we do at unpacking it and integrating it, the boy code becomes more flexible. We still need parameters, but they can become a little more flexible and fluid. And helping boys to navigate that becomes very important, particularly with boys of different masculinities. So I always like a nice little quote to end here. Some references, and thank you for your time.
Well, we have a number of minutes remaining for questions.
The ACA response to new program in Tennessee, is it going to have an effect upon enrollment?
No, because they didn't find they didn't slap it out. And there wasn't, I mean, with, there was the, you know, obviously, you know, men didn't, a lot of the services didn't really expand to men in general, so there was sort of that other difference as well. So, for two reasons, not, not much.
And also, any attempt to find out what adverse childhood experiences are having in that population? I mean, it's a typical question to ask people, obviously, so how would you ever approach it?
I'm sorry, which?
But adverse childhood experiences.
Oh, well, we didn't, not through this work. Because this was just looking at existing data, so no, there was no way we could get at that. But I do have colleagues in different places who are doing that kind of work, looking more at, you know, different types of, you know, mental health issues, sexual risk, and so forth, and looking at how those early childhood experiences shape that. But yeah.
I don't know how Tennessee ranked in the type of response to ACA. How does it rank?
They didn't respond too much at all.
You have a question?
This question is also for Eric. I mean, I think it's actually really exciting when you see how surveys actually measure over the course of time, and it's too bad that the policy that's changed. Have you seen in the years that the report kind of happens, if you talk about policy changes or programs that have started at local places in response to the issues that have identified?
So there's been more attention to it. I don't know that I can honestly point to a lot of very tangible changes, other than there's more of a broad sort of statewide sort of recognition that needs to be more attention to it. You know, I don't think report cards can certainly take that much credit for it. I think, you know, again, you have sort of folks on the ground, Tennessee Men's Health Network and other groups who do this year-round, and, you know, we do this every couple of years. But I think there's just generally a broader sort of recognition that this is an important issue, and that this is a tool that some of the you know, educators, community-based organizations, and so forth are using to say we need to pay more attention to this. And so trying to break it down in ways that make it more accessible is sort of the best strategy. We did have, so one of the things we did do, I will say, is, I didn't include them here, is infographics. So we actually did, when they were, exploring the conversation about expanding ACA and so forth, we did actually have infographics that we had a student create from the report card about sort of the different age groups and what was the leading cause of death and how this would actually relate, and then made the report card available and so forth. So we have done those kind of things, and again, in collaboration with other groups to try to get that word out.
Sure.
This is a terrific meeting. Giving you my card to join. I hope to come to dinner and get to talk to everybody tonight. I am a person who has said something that's really bad, and I didn't realize I was saying it all these days. And I was saying, if you want a better interview, because they'll take more time and they're better at talking to patients, hire a nurse. And I still believe that's true. But there's no reason why men can't be taught to give those kinds of interviews about, and I think that I actually have the BEMSEX inventory in my cohort, and I was very interested to see that the people who I wanted to see if anybody was still using it. Mm-hmm. So I did a midline search, you've probably done this too. And the people who are still using this is male OBGYNs, because they want to hire feminine scoring nurses. It just blows me away also. So it is interesting how these stereotypes, we're talking about how difficult it is for men, it's clearly more difficult because there's more expectations and confusing ones. I think men become sexual at an age where they're really totally unprepared for it, whereas women usually are not worrying about not having sex yet. I mean, some of them. That was a really enlightening talk in all the levels that I learned a lot here, so thank you. I should say that I have an all-male cohort in aging, healthy aging, which is osteoporosis. I'm going to go up there. I'm actually going there to that meeting now in San Francisco. I will be
talking about what we need to do more of the